brought to you by ConcordiaTheology.org, bringing you resources that support the vigorous life of the mind in service of the gospel of Christ.
Welcome to Lectionary Kickstart. We're sparking your thoughts for Sunday as you plan your sermon or teaching lesson. I'm your host, Jessica Bordalo, here with Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker. They're both professors of homiletics here at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. You can hear all about us in our introductory episode, but trust me, they're pretty good preachers. Okay, let's get started. David, where are we in the church year?
We are at the 15th week after Pentecost, a time when the church celebrates the life of the Spirit.
And Peter, what's the text for this week?
The text for this week are taken from Ezekiel 33, Romans chapter 13, and Matthew 18.
So every week in the show, each of you share which text you would preach on. And this week, Peter, you're first.
Last week, if you recall, I was kind of struck by a statement that that Jesus made to Peter in Matthew 16, verse 23, where he said, "You are not setting your minds on the things of God, but on the things of man." And when I was looking at that reading, I noticed that the next couple of gospel readings all seem to kind of lift up one way in which the disciples and we today probably are tempted to think in human terms rather than set our minds on the things of God.
So you're thinking about a series.
Yeah. So last week, you know, the idea was suffering. He was not thinking about suffering like Jesus was. Jesus was talking about how he would suffer and he would die and rise, and Peter couldn't handle it, so he had to cut him off. This week, Peter's thinking, Peter and the other disciples, I guess, are thinking wrongly and in a different way. And so would you maybe start us by reading Matthew 18, 1-4, Jessica?
At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly, I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven."
This reading begins with a question, right? It just makes you shake your head, doesn't it? Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? I mean, doesn't it sound like kind of playground, like children?
Yeah, king of the hill, right? Yeah.
But I was trying to think of examples of when someone asks a question that's just kind of the wrong question, that you shouldn't even really answer the question as it's asked, because it shows how off their thinking is.
Yes, at home,
can
my kids.
Can either of you think of a question
yes,
like that?
All the time. Why do we have to wash dishes? You know, what? School isn't important anyway. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that there's certain questions. I mean, you learn this as a pastor, you learn this as a parent, you learn this as a teacher. Sometimes people ask a question and you really shouldn't answer that question. So an example of this, when the disciples want to call down fire on...
Oh, yeah, right. On the village, the Samaritan village.
And, yeah. You know, should we call down fire? That's a bad question.
Well, even worse would be, how much fire should we
That's
call
right.
down?
How hot do you want it?
How hot do you want it?
But so these, I guess the point that struck me as I was looking at this is sometimes the questions we ask arise out of setting our minds on the things of man instead of the things of God. And we only ask such questions because it's like your kid asking, you know, why do I have to do the dishes or something? You only ask that question when you have some sort of sense of, well, I shouldn't have to do something like that.
Right.
So what I like about this text is that Jesus, at least at first, he doesn't really answer the question. They say, "Who's the greatest?" And you can imagine Jesus looking around and he calls to him a child. It's funny.
Imagine what that would be like, right? So you're waiting for him to answer who is the greatest, and he's looking around, and then all of a sudden he brings a child in. And you're going to think, oh, he is so crazy.
Right. And the fact that he calls a child to himself, he's apparently doing this in front of others.
Right.
I mean, I think we kind of know that Jesus was often teaching kind of on the way. And it's not uncommon for him to say, "Hey, look at this little child," or "Hey, look at this," or "Hey, look at that."
Give me some cultural context on the view of children. Because in our culture, children are so highly valued and so important, more important than anything else, really. I mean, it seems to be a cultural norm, but it was different back then, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
You'd especially if you judge by the amount of money we spend on youth sports, you would conclude that the children are very important. And I don't think this was the case back then. I think children were basically, I think they were helpful when they could help. But they didn't really have a place or I don't think many.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Gibbs does some good work with that on laying out in his commentary on Matthew about the role of children in the society. And it's, you know, we tend to adore children. We think that they're cute, they're beautiful, they're, you know, we fill them with images of hope for the future, and not the case.
We live vicariously through them.
Right, right. Yeah, that's why we spend so much money on the sports.
Right, exactly. Right, yeah. Exactly. What's important, I think, is that sometimes we import things that we think about kids back into that culture.
Right.
That's why I asked.
Because otherwise you're going to have this really sentimental moment, right? That's what happens.
Yeah, the idea that children are pure,
sweet,
or innocent,
and pure,
or that they're so trusting.
That
gets me. I mean, you hang out with a little child; they don't trust. They don't trust you at all.
Nor are they innocent.
They're certainly not innocent. But I
well, maybe not your children. But
That's true. I remember when my kids were younger, and you know, you'd be in the pool, and you'd say, you know, jump to me, I'll catch you.
Wow.
And my daughter would just look at me and, no way, I don't trust you. That water's deep. You're crazy. But sometimes people read a text like this and they say, oh, children are so trusting. So become like a child. Become trusting.
Right. Become pure. Become innocent.
And that I think that's totally reading a current conception of children into the text. So I think you'd want to do a little bit of look at what a child is back then. But then so Jesus turns to them and he grabs this child and he puts the child in the midst of them and says, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom, enter the reign of God. It's not just now who's great and who's
not
so great.
Right, who's even going to get in?
You have no place. I mean, and I think you can read it a little bit like this. This kind of question doesn't belong in the reign of God. This is not how we think. This is not how we talk. We don't think about greatness, and we don't think about who's who's ahead of another, and so Jesus is kind of putting them in their place with this child, and then verse 4 there, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So now we're thinking about, okay, what kind of kingdom is this? What kind of reign is this? It's not a reign where there is greatness is honored or adored. Greatness is so highly valued in our culture. And Jesus is basically saying here, that's not the right way to think in this kingdom. The right way to think is a humbleness, a humility.
It makes me think of that moment when Jesus, in the upper room, when he took off his outer garment and wrapped himself in a towel and started washing their feet, right?
Right.
So they've... Yeah. You know, that's the servant's task. It was below any of them. So they all go in and they don't wash their feet at all because no one's there to do it and they're not going to do it. And then Jesus comes and does it. And it's just a transformative moment. And if I, your master, would do this, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that gets, of course, to Jesus as the one who is the greatest.
The greatest by being the least.
By becoming the least and becoming a servant to
all. Right, right.
And so this turns the whole conception of the reign of God upside down in a way that I think would kind of call out the false thinking that happens not just for the disciples but with us, and also gives you a great segue or a great runway to proclaim the humble, sacrificial love of God in Christ. Beginning with, or maybe highlighting this, I like that with in a sermon, I might go to that example of Jesus washing the feet. And if you think that's humble,
right? Yeah.
You know, then what followed with his
where do you see what he does with your
death.
Sin? Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Why do you think that? You think just for you, is it just because culturally greatness is so important to us that's why you would? That's why you're drawn to that?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think it even seeps into the church. You know, we do a good job sometimes as Christians recognizing how we're not given into cultural ways of thinking. You know, some of the social issues, this becomes very obvious. But the underlying attitudes and behaviors that we manifest, I think, you know, we just are, whether it be what you wear or how successful your church is, mm-hmm. or how pious you are.
How many nights a week you spend at church.
How many nights a week you're yeah. at church. How often do we, you know, kind of humble brag about how overly committed we are and we're so right. busy because we're, right. you know, I got to get my kid to this and then I got to go serve at this. And
we all have our standards of greatness.
We all have our standards of greatness. Right. And I yeah. think you got to, that's so antithetical toward the reign of God in Christ. And I think that's what Jesus is calling out here with the disciples.
Yeah.
And so I think there's almost no end to how much you could peel back that underlying search for greatness in our culture today.
What about you, David? What would you preach on?
Well, you know, I looked at the Matthew text, and there were just so many different vectors to that text.
Yeah.
You know, there were like four different sermons, right. you know, portions of it. And I'm like, oh, I can't do that. And then so the Old Testament reading was very, very short. And I'm like, I need something short and to the point. And so the Old Testament reading is the one I would go with. So, Jessica, if you could read Ezekiel 33, 7 to 9.
I'm so glad you picked this one because this is the hardest one to understand.
And
scary.
It is scary.
Yes. Right? Okay. I'm so glad you picked it. Okay.
Yep.
Ezekiel 33, 7 to 9. So you, son of man, I have made a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked, O wicked one, you shall surely die, and you do not speak to warn the wicked to turn from his way, that wicked person shall die in his iniquity. But his blood I will require at your hand. But if you warn the wicked to turn from his way, and he does not turn from his way, that person shall die in his iniquity, but you will have delivered your soul.
Okay.
See, that's terrifying.
It is terrifying. I agree. It's a terrifying text.
Great. Explain
it
to
is.
Me.
Well, it's not so much explaining. I think for me, it's the imagery of the text that intrigues me, right? So you're talking about a watchman or a sentinel, right? And so you would have a city that would have walls around it, and there'd be a place on the wall where somebody could stand on top of the wall and look in the distance and see what was coming. So if somebody is coming to siege the city, it may take them a while to get there, and you would be able to be on top of that wall, see the people coming, and warn the people of what was about to happen. And so, you know, God uses this imagery of a watchman on a wall who would be ready to call the people to battle, call the people to arms, warn them of what was coming, blow a horn to, you know, awaken the people so that they would know danger is on its way. Yeah, so the imagery picks up this idea of a person who's able to see into the distance, and because what they see, they speak to the people in the city. And God kind of changes the imagery a little bit when, you know, the watchman is to listen. And the watchman's going to hear a word from God, right? And what was the word that God says?
Oh, wicked, you will surely die.
right, yeah. Oh, wicked, you will surely die.
I think that counts as law.
I know. And you speak to warn the wicked to turn from his way. So the language here is not specific and concrete, right? It's not, you know, stop beating your wife. It's, you know, you shall surely die, turn from the way. And so the surely die stuff, that evokes back to Genesis. You know, if you eat the fruit of the tree, mm-hmm. you will surely die, right? So we've got this very broad, traditional, foundational language that God has laws that are in place for our good. And God warns us when we're coming close to breaking those laws. And all of this traditional imagery and language is being spoken to a people who are in a world where everything about their life of faith has been ripped apart. Ezekiel is speaking to exiles, right? So they have been taken to Babylon. The temple has been destroyed. the sacrificial system is gone, and you are now living in a strange new city, a strange new land, and God is giving you imagery to let you know that his kingdom is still in this place. I want you to imagine that the kingdom is still here. And I want you to imagine that I still bring about the kingdom through words that I speak. And yes, they're words of warning, but when you are displaced and taken to a world that is completely different, you need words of warning to help you figure out how to live in this land. I mean, you know, you think about that. Your sacrificial system's gone, your temple's gone, you're displaced, you're placed in a new land. It's kind of like, you know, you just cut your losses and try to start anew.
Right. I mean, you don't see anything of the old
nothing.
World.
Nothing. Nothing of the old world is there anymore.
The concept of a watchman or a tower or a sentinel or anything like that, there is no wall.
No, there is no wall. There is no city anymore.
Right.
We are exiles. We're not living together among ourselves. We're just kind of spread out in this land. We've been exiled and the kingdom has fallen apart. And so let's just move on. It's a new day and let's pick up the pieces and move on. And yet God has a word for people who are living in a world that has become vastly different. And it's a word that is saying there is somebody that I am appointing who's going to speak a word that helps you recognize the kingdom.
Word itself and the sending of the watchman itself
is a gracious
thing.
It's an amazing gracious thing, even though it's a scary word.
Well, it's scary for two reasons.
Yeah.
First of all, because the personal responsibility that you would incur.
That the watchman
has.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By not telling. It is also scary because it kind of sounds like you should go on a street corner with a sign that says, repent or burn.
Right.
I think it could be.
Well, there's a word. There's a word about life. God's desire is for people to have life, not death. And the word is calling people away from the things that lead to death toward a way that leads for life. And this is a really, really, really bad analogy, but I'm going
to
say it.
Those are the most fun to think about. Maybe not to preach on, but to think about.
Yeah, just think about it.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I was playing pickleball. Okay,
there
we go.
Your last analogy was about pickleball, too.
I know.
This is great.
Did I really talk about pickleball last time?
You did, about
the woman
who got tangled in the net and everyone helped her.
I am so old, yes. So I was playing pickleball, and my partner, I have this problem. When I'm playing pickleball, I get into the game, and I just want to hit the ball as hard as possible, even though you should hit it really lightly sometimes. But I'm in the game, and my goal is to hit the ball and get it over the net, right? And I'm not watching the lines, which means that there could be a ball that's coming too high in the air. And, you know, I'm 6'4". I might not recognize that it would go out if I let it go. And
instead,
I'm like, no, I'm going to jump and kill that thing. Yeah. Right. So I'm like so into the game that I don't watch the lines. And so I said to my partner when the game started, if you could watch the lines, I said, then I will. I said, just call it if it's going out. And it was great. It worked great because if I heard him call, it's out, I would just pull back and stop. But if he didn't call, I would just keep playing. And so I was free to play the game because I had somebody who was calling the ball when it would go out. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
And so you've been taken into exile. Mm-hmm. You're playing pickleball. There's no lines that anyone can see. You don't even have a paddle, but you're still trying to play the game, and you don't know how to do it. Yeah. And somebody's calling the lines for you.
But the street corner thing is sometimes that comes across or is delivered in a way that seems almost angry and condemning. Instead of I'm trying to help, and I'm trying to bring this good news.
Right. That what you're trying to do, the goal, is to prevent people from dying. The goal is to help people who are living in a world that has gone so haywire, they have no idea how to walk the way it's so hard to walk the way. I am in the game. I want to walk the way, and I'm trying to walk the way, but I need somebody to tell me where the lines are, because it's crazy out there. And so the watchman is kind of calling the lines for you so that you're free to live. You're free and to this, try to live.
And this appreciates, or this recognizes that Ezekiel's talking to the house of Israel.
Right.
This is the household. It's not him going to the nations with this message.
Right.
And so I'm reading this, and I'm thinking about the community of believers and the role that the preacher has to do this gracious work of kind of calling the lines and helping the members see. It's kind of a second or third or fourth step would be, okay, what about kind of going out into the community? But let's start right here.
So you're talking to people who want to play pickleball.
Right.
Not
who are
the people
already
who are,
in the game.
They're not watching from the sidelines and you're yelling at them.
Right. No. These are the people who are already in the game.
That is
but
different.
The whole court has been destroyed. The net's not even there. I may not have a paddle, but we know that we've been called to play the game, and we just don't know how to do it anymore.
And that, I mean, we're not in exile entirely, but man, I'm sure there's congregations who feel like that.
Well, yeah.
That things have crumbled, and it's not what it used to be.
It's not what it used to be, so how do we continue to be Christians?
Right.
I don't want to walk away from the church. I don't want to leave the church. I want to be a Christian in a world that's gone haywire. And I'm just trying the best I can.
So, Dave, let's think about this just a little bit. How do you preach this sermon as a pastor without focusing too much on yourself?
Yeah, I know that's the problem.
That's one thing. It was always a little weird to talk about yourself as the pastor and your role. And so, I'm wondering if maybe you could get at this by talking about a watchman in your life as someone who's like, kind of like what you do with the pickleball thing.
Yeah.
But instead of saying, I'm the watchman, you guys,
right,
I'm
right.
going to tell you where the lines are.
Yeah. Instead, I've had a watchman.
I've had a watchman.
And here's what it does for me.
Right.
It frees me up.
And in doing so, you don't even have to talk about yourself and your role as watchman.
Right.
But you can be that person by sharing how someone has been that for you.
Right. Yeah, I would agree. And that that's what godparents are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think you can think of our roles as parents and godparents.
Okay, so here, now, I like what you came up with godparents, because godparents are kind of hard. How do you address godparents? And it's kind of thing you want to remind people, a lot of Christians are godparents to kids, and they're not quite sure what to do.
And just think about it, why do you choose a godparent? Because you know.
To show who's the favorite uncle.
No, no, that's not why. No, you choose a godparent because the world could go haywire.
Yes.
You could lose your life. Who knows what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
You could walk away from the faith. But at this point in time, I want to make sure if that happens to me, I want to make sure that somebody's there to take care of my kids.
So you could. I'm thinking in a sermon, you could either share, maybe some of you who are listening have stories of godparents who have done that. Maybe you haven't, but you can just imagine that kind of situation. Or you can just call to mind the last baptism that took place in your congregation and say, do you realize what the godparents were doing up here?
Right.
They were being installed as watchmen for this child.
Yeah, I mean, I think, AC and Jessica, I think you are right. You are spot on that we hear this text and we're kind of like, oh, there's this neat, mean, nasty, angry God who's going to be attacking people, and this is what the culture hates and everything. But I think the way to read the text is, like you were saying, to think of it not as this is the God at work out in the culture. This is a God working among his people and speaking to his people and assuring them that I have placed a watchman for you so that somebody's going to be there to call the lines for you. And I think husband and wife sometimes act as a watch person for one another.
Well,
right?
And this is part of the mutual conversation and consolation of brothers and sisters that we talk about as Lutherans, where we serve in those capacities for each other. The pastor does it on behalf of the congregation, but all members, all believers, speak this word of warning sometimes and of comfort. And you become a community. What I love about the possibilities of this text is you become kind of a community of those who speak the word of God to each other.
Right.
And you
out
build
of love.
Out of love.
And recognize why you need it. Why you need that word sometimes.
Right.
You know?
So that it's heard as not just criticism, but gift.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And that's all for today. We have free resources to guide your next step in planning at concordiatheology.org. Check it out. You can find more episodes of this show on Spotify, Google, Apple. If you'd like to see the show continue, please subscribe, share, leave a review. We'll read all of them. I'm your host and producer, Jessica Bordolo. Join us next week here at Lectionary Kickstart when Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker spark your thoughts for next Sunday.
Should we call down fire? That's a bad question.
Well, even worse would be how much fire should we call down?
How hot do you want it?
How hot do you want it?